For generations, white men sat on top of America's economic ladder. Today, white men are often out of work, their pension funds raided or depleted, with people who don't look like them, women, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, competing for what's left. Sociologist Michael Kimmel says they fill the airwaves with the vitriol of aggrieved entitlement, what people feel when they lose something they deserve. Michael Kimmel spent hundreds of hours hearing out their grievances, hearing the anger that might draw one to call Rush Limbaugh, another to join the Tea Party, a few to join racist organizations, and in extreme cases, to violence in the home or workplace. Angry White Men, next on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Politicians and marketing gurus are fond of saying that demographics are destiny. So it shouldn't have surprised anyone that America's once dominant political caste reacted with outrage in 2012 when the nation elected its first black president for the second time, despite 8% unemployment. That anger hasn't abated one bit. And our next guest argues that white men have held the upper hand for so long that they can't come to grips with the notion that most of the country isn't like them anymore, in the workplace, in politics, on the sidewalks. Demographics are slowly equalizing the playing field, and the result among white males is an explosive rage rather than the quieter despair, anxiety, and frustration of many others who feel mistreated by life. Theirs is the anger of the entitled. We are entitled to those jobs, those positions of unchallenged dominance, sociologist Michael Kimmel writes. And when we're told we are not going to get them, we get angry. The title of Michael Kimmel's new book, Angry White Men, reflects hundreds of hours spent hearing out the grievances of working and middle-class white men, men who feel betrayed by employers who outsource their jobs and raided their pension funds, by unions that don't win victories for them anymore, by a government that's overly intrusive and controlled by big corporations and special interests that aren't their interests. Suddenly they're competing for jobs and promotions with more and more people who don't look like them, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and women of all colors. Michael Kimmel calls their attitude aggrieved entitlement, a feeling that some outside power has snatched away what they feel entitled to by birth or social position. Some, Michael Kimmel writes, react by calling Rush Limbaugh or joining the Tea Party or a men's rights group. But there are other, more sinister manifestations of this rage, including domestic violence, involvement in white supremacy groups, and even mass murder. Going postal, he notes, is almost exclusively the realm of angry white men. Although he concedes his progressive leanings and a pro-feminist background, Michael Kimmel expresses sympathy for the people he writes about. Angry white men have some justified grievances, he says, even though they often aim their arrows at the wrong targets. Michael Kimmel is a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York. He's written or edited more than 20 books, including Manhood in America, The Gendered Society, and the one we liked last time we spoke, Guyland. His latest is titled Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. Michael Kimmel, it's nice to get you on the Midday Show back here in Baltimore. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here, Dan. Thanks.
This is so interesting. I hardly know where to begin, but I'm going to begin with aggrieved entitlement and that word entitlement. And I just want to quote one more thing from your book, and then ask you about it, okay?
Sure.
Their sense of grievance depends on their sense of entitlement, what they believe is their rightful place in the world. That sense of entitlement can come from many places. It can come from specific promises made and unkept. Some promises, like campaign promises, are specific, but more often they're abstract, like the American dream, that if a man works hard, is an honest and upstanding citizen, he will be rewarded with a good job that will enable him to support a family and give his children a solid foundation for their future. Ironically, you say, this is where I want to start, The sense of entitlement is a marker of privilege. Those who have nothing don't feel they deserve anything. Those who already have something believe they are entitled to it. When one feels that slipping, one may idealize that earlier time when privilege was unexamined and assumed, and rage at those who seem to be taking what you thought was rightfully yours. I'm really interested in this idea that entitlement, those who already have something believe they are entitled to it versus those who are striving.
Well, I have to say first, Dan, that was a lovely introduction, okay. And I want to quote it in the future. But let me explain this idea of entitlement from the passage that you just read. Let me explain how I started to think about writing this book, why I actually did it. There's actually a story in the book that I tell that was the very first time where I encountered this sense of entitlement. And I was on a talk show, a TV talk show, opposite four guys who were, and I now came to call angry white men. They were white men, middle-class guys, who felt that they were the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace, that affirmative action was actually reverse discrimination against white men. And they were qualified for jobs, and they were qualified for promotions, and they didn't get them, and they were really angry about it. And the title of this particular show was a quote from one of these men. And the quote was very simple. He said, "A black woman stole my job." So they all told their stories about how they were qualified for jobs and promotions and it wasn't fair, et cetera. And then it was my turn to speak. And I said, "I have just one question for you guys. And it's about the title of the show, A Black Woman Stole My Job. Actually, it's about one word in the title. I want to know about the word my. Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why isn't the title of the show A Black Woman Got the Job? Or A Black Woman Got a Job? Because without understanding that sense of entitlement, that these were our jobs, then you won't understand why so many men are angry about the forces that have, in fact, hurt them, stiffed them, left them out in the cold. In fact, you know, one of the things that I argue in the book is that, people in the United States do have a right to be angry. There's a lot of truth to what they were saying. But as you say, I think they just are delivering their mail to the wrong address. To believe that a black woman is responsible for your unhappiness sort of misses the point. Black women are not responsible for climate change. You know, immigrants are not the ones who are the predatory lenders. LGBT people did not outsource your job. That sense of entitlement also leads people to the right very often because they end up being asked or seduced or at least it's suggested to them that they blame those below them on the social scale mm-hmm. rather than those above them.
Mm-hmm. You know, the men that you interviewed in so many different settings, different ways, different places, and we're going to talk about that during the hour, they probably wouldn't think of themselves as children of privilege. Yet they have this sense of entitlement. So there's something of a conflict there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think this idea of privilege is it's invisible to us most of the time. You know, privilege is invisible to those who have it. We don't think about the things that privilege us. For example, being a white person, being a man, I've always thought that this was a way that how privilege works is you just don't see it. I mean, I was in a conversation once with, where a white woman was explaining at the time that, you know, all women face the same oppression and all women therefore have a kind of a solidarity or sisterhood. And a black woman just said, "Well, I don't know if I agree. I mean, let me ask you a question." So the black woman says to the white woman, "When you wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror, what do you see?" And the white woman said, "I see a woman." And the black woman said, "Well, you see, that's the problem for me, because when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror," she said, "I see a black woman. To me, race is visible. But to you, race is invisible. You don't see it." And she said, "That's how privilege works. Privilege is invisible to those who have it." So I was listening to this conversation and I went and I kind of groaned, you know, and I said, "Well," and somebody said, "Well, what was that about?" I said, "Well, you know, when I wake up in the morning,
I see a human being. You know, I'm a middle-class white man. I have no race, no class, no gender. I'm universally generalizable. And I think only a middle-class straight white man could say he was universally generalizable.
But men, modern men, men who are with us today, men in their 40s, 50s, 60s, men and even younger men, they believe that they were on track, that they were given a course to take in life, and that life would provide certain things as it did for their fathers and grandfathers. Is that where it comes from?
Yeah, for sure. Look, just because I'm saying as analytically that we, you know, white men have privilege, I am not for a minute saying that then white men should be walking around going, "Oh my gosh, I'm so privileged." We're quite unaware of the ways in which we're privileged. You know, I live in New York City, and when I walk outside and I want to take a taxi, I put my handout, and if I'm lucky, a taxi cab will stop in front of me. But a black man will have cabs go right by him that are empty and that are for hire because people are afraid, you know, cab drivers are often afraid to stop. So I wouldn't see that privilege of the cab stopping for me. The cab just stops. You would only see it if you put your hand out and they don't stop. Mm-hmm. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, we white men have to sort of acknowledge all of this privilege, but to listen to the ways in which we do have that sense of entitlement, that is much more important than a sense of privilege to me. Because you're exactly right, Dan. Most of the guys I talk to, they've kind of been blindsided by the dramatic and unbelievably rapid changes that have taken place in our society. I mean, think about the rapidity of these changes. My father's generation, my father's workplace looked like the set of Mad Men. Mm-hmm. You know, all the men had the offices with the windows on the outside, and all of the women were kind of gathered in a corral in the center. And it was a kind of office perk that you got, you know, your access to any of the women that you wanted. That's what workplaces looked like. So, you know, in one short generation, it now looks like, you know, the supervisor is as likely to be a woman as a man. You know, it's a completely different workplace. Things have completely changed. And a lot of guys, it's not that they're necessarily angry, but they do feel somewhat blindsided. They do feel somehow that they weren't prepared for this.
Right.
And a lot of guys even told me quite plaintively, they would say something like, "Geez, if I knew I wasn't getting, you know, I signed up for this masculinity thing because, you know, I figured there were going to be big rewards. You know, I'd get sex, I'd get rich. If I knew I wasn't going to get them, I might not have signed up."
Do they realize that they're angry? Because we come back to this word anger. It's in the title of your book, Angry. Is that what's different about today than other times? The level of anger that's registered against the government, Obama, the political system, women, minorities. Is that what intrigues you about this?
Well, you know, it's ironic to me, in a sense, and I wanted to get that irony about that emotion, anger, because some cases they're angry because it's been manipulated, and in other cases they're angry because they think bad things really have happened. They've been downsized or outsourced, then they're now making half of what they used to make, and they grew up thinking, as I did, and maybe, you know, other listeners did. I grew up thinking that, you know, I was going to be the family provider and the protector, and I should make the living. This idea in my college, we would literally sit around and ask that age-old question, will you let your wife work? Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you know, by the time I'm a baby boomer, by the time we got there, you know, it's like, of course, if she's going to do anything she wants. But my father, when he was in college, they seriously asked that question. And the let your wife work part was kind of taken for granted. And most of the guys said, "Oh, well, no, you know, I really feel like it's my responsibility." So guys walk around with this feeling that they are supposed to be the provider, that this is their responsibility as men, as husbands, as fathers. And then they find that they're unable to do it. And they're bewildered by it. They're confused by it. They're upset and anxious about it. And many of them get angry and politicize that anger. And one of the political parties in the United States today is built on trying to harness that resentment against these changes so that they can turn the clock back.
Michael Kimmel is our guest in this hour of midday, professor of sociology at Stony Brook, author now of Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. A short break here on Midday. We'll come back and continue our conversation. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. My guest this hour is Michael Kimmel, sociologist, author. His latest book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, a provocative book that goes a long way toward explaining the rage that exploded over the airwaves when Barack Obama was elected to his second term. You might remember the lament of Bill O'Reilly, who said that he didn't live in a traditional America anymore, given the results of the 2012 election. And Michael, we're back here. Something I'm interested in here, you expressed some sympathy, and you started to just before the break there. You know, you certainly wear your liberal political orientation on your sleeve, and you say you have a lot of sympathy, though, for these guys. What exactly are they complaining about that you feel is actually justified?
Well, I think a lot of these guys really have gotten a bad deal. As I said, as I said earlier, you know, I think that their targets are misguided. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're, you know, here's the way I put it. I think their anger is real. That is, it's real emotions based on real events. But it's not true. Which is to say, it's not an accurate analysis of their situation. I mean, let me just say, Dan, you know, it's not just guys on the extreme right who are angry about their political fate, the economic changes in the society. It's also, you know, here's a couple of examples of angry white men. How about Tom Joad and Bruce Springsteen? Tom Joad, you know, of course, goes off and sees his position, his plight in the great book, The Grapes of Wrath. He goes off and he sees his position as being badly done by the government, by the corporations mm-hmm. that don't care about their workers. And Bruce Springsteen is another. I mean, he sort of channels Tom Joad these days. And there, because what I think is, if you take your anger and you blame women, people of color, immigrants, LGBT, you're going to turn to the right. But if you blame, as you did in your introduction to the book, predatory lenders, large corporations that are, you know, that act to, you know, against their own workers' interests, I mean, then you're going to move to the left. So there's nothing inevitable about angry white men, you know, being the base of the Republican Party. They could just as easily be the base of a resurgent Democratic sort of progressive movement.
Mm-hmm. And so some of this is justified, you say, some of this anger.
Well, I think that, as I said, a lot of these guys do feel like they've been badly done by, and many of them are right.
They just picked the wrong target, which is the part where we always scratch our head. For instance, the Tea Party. And, you know, we've debated this and talked about this. I want my country back. You know, the cry of the Tea Party
right.
way back in the original. Actually, it was a woman who said that. It wasn't a man.
Right. But,
you know, when the Tea Party sort of became more visible and loud, it was coincided with the election of Obama. It coincided also with the recession and mm-hmm. all of that. So I'm curious, in terms of picking the right target, do you find a lot of the folks you talk to from the Tea Party sort of off target?
Well, when I talk to the Tea Party people, a lot of the time, I mean, they said things, you know, they said exactly that. Well, we want our country back. And the New York Times op-ed columnist Charles Blow recently, you know, wrote, well, you can't have it. You know, it's like, I mean, in a way, you gotta admit, this is a done deal. I mean, look, America today, I mean, all the other things to the side, and I want to emphasize a strong caveat here. We have never been in our history more racially equal than we are today. We have never in our history been more sexually equal than we are today. We've never in our history been more gender equal than we are today. Now, are we there yet? Of course not. There's still plenty of racial, sexual, gender discrimination. I get all that. But let's be clear, we have, I mean, the rapidity of this change. I mean, even, you know, most of us are probably sitting here thinking, would we ever, you know, 10 years ago, did you think that like same-sex marriage would have progressed so quickly? That we would have three women at the head of the three major car, you know, auto companies? It's really kind of mind-blowing in some respects how fast these changes have taken place, despite the fact that, yes, we do have a long way to go. So we are not going to have a moment. You know, women are not going to have a V8 moment where they hit themselves in the head and they go, oh my God, they were right. You know, this voting and working and climbing the corporate ladder and leaning in and all that stuff. But, you know, it's not worth it. Let's go home. they're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm, right.
So it's a done deal. The question for men is, what are we going to do about the world that has changed so dramatically in our lifetime and is changing so fast right under our feet? And there's three options. You can fight back, you can be resigned and accommodate yourself to it, or you can say, what's in it for me? And there are a lot of guys in that last category who are saying, well, you know what's in it for me? I have better relationships with my kids. I have better friendships. I'm much more, I like my life better. I like my wife better. It's not simply a zero-sum game here. I believe that when women and LGBT people and minorities win, so do straight white men.
Well, see, men don't get that. Men don't get that feminism liberates them as well as women.
Yeah. But I want to tell you—
right? I mean, that's been a long time. That's been a problem for a while, right?
That's true. It's true.
That they don't see that.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the targets,
okay.
though. The targets of
yeah,
their
sure.
anger, okay? Because this is a part that I find particularly confusing to me. I look at the minimum wage battle, for instance. We have a minimum wage battle underway here in Maryland in the legislature, whether to raise it or not. And the people who seem to give voice to the anti-increase in the minimum wage, who don't think that would be a good thing for our economy, are the people who seem to me would benefit from it. That's the working class, middle class people. So I wonder what it's like for you when you talk to someone who's sort of conservative and angry about all that's happened, and you get to those economic issues, and their target is, people competing with them for jobs, black women, Asian men, whoever it is, but they don't see that the problem is elsewhere. This age of economic disparity that we're in, they don't even seem to want to acknowledge that that has something to do with why they're so angry.
Yeah, I mean, this is the brilliance of Thomas Frank's book. This is a "What's the Matter with Kansas" moment, right?
Right.
Because after all, the minimum wage hasn't been increased in the United States in 30 years. It's not kept pace with inflation. It doesn't go up as prices go up. It actually has remained pretty flat. So it's obviously in our interest to raise the minimum wage, especially for low wage workers. And so it seems to me this should be a no-brainer. But here's a case where they're being distracted by saying, well, if we do this, then we have to raise prices even more because we can't give up, profits. And where small businesses are really afraid of raising the minimum wage because they're afraid that that if they do that, that their costs will go up so much that they'll have to lay workers off. And so then there's the possibility that raising the minimum wage would actually increase unemployment. People are so frightened. I mean, imagine people who work for a living and are trying to make as much as they can being so afraid to advocate for higher wages because they feel their lives, their working lives, are so precarious.
Right.
Something is wrong with that picture, and it makes them very vulnerable. And the vulnerability is, that's right, the reason that you are not getting what you want is not because you're not being paid adequately. It's because these other people are willing to work for less and people are paying them.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about some of the characters in your book, the people that you interviewed, because you did spend a lot of time talking to these folks. And I wonder what that was like for you sometimes if you ended up in debates with people. Let's start with Rick. Rick is a pretty interesting guy,
okay.
Charming fellow that you met up in Pennsylvania, right?
Right, right. Well, originally I thought I really was interested in how masculinity, gender issues were sort of playing out in the extreme right. And so I decided that I was going to do research on the extreme right by hanging out on their websites. I mean, this for many of the people on the extreme right, they're very they're survivalists. They live in cabins in Montana, but they all have websites. I mean, they're the most wired anti-modernists you've ever encountered. And so I thought I would hang out on some of their web pages and some of their chat rooms and in their web portals. But so I would be in a chat room and I would be listening into the conversations that people were having back and forth over a period of hours. And there would be like six people in it. And gradually it dawned on me that I had no way to know whether these six people were actually like white supremacists and white nationalists and neo-Nazis, or whether, you know, five of them were graduate students in anthropology doing their field work and one was a high school kid just goofing around and one of them might have been like an actual, you know, white nationalist. I had no way to know this. So I said, all right, I got to go meet them. So I thought, well, it's going to be, you know, and this is of interest to Maryland listeners. All my friends said, oh, my gosh, you're going to have to go to like the deep south. And I said, nah, probably not. What I ended up doing was I went across the traditional Mason-Dixon line, mostly to southern tier of Pennsylvania, where there's quite a large number of Klansmen and white nationalists. And I basically would go to gun shows on weekends that were held at like public schools. High schools would rent out their gym to a gun show because, of course, all the public schools are strapped for cash. So anybody who's going to rent out their gym, they'd be perfectly happy to rent it. And so outside, you know, inside the gym, there were just tons and tons of tables with guns. But outside, there was always a table with literature and a couple of guys standing around. And the literature was how the government's trying to do this to you and how they're taking away your right to bear arms and they're taking away these rights and that those rights. And those were my guys. So I would walk up to them, and your listeners can't see me, but believe me, I don't look like the guys that you think I was encountering. I'm sort of, you know, middle-aged, balding, Jewish-looking, glasses, sociologist, you know, from Brooklyn, New York. So there's no way I'm going to, like, fake it, right?
You're at a gun show in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania?
That's right. I'm not going to fake this. I'm not going to say, you know, howdy, partners. You know, it's like, that's not going to happen. Yeah. So I basically said, you know, hi, is this your literature? And they said, who are you? And I said, well, I'm a sociologist from New York. And you know, I just bantering back and forth, and I said, "Look, I'm your worst nightmare. You know, I'm a middle class, you know, Jewish sociologist from the bluest state, the bluest city, and the bluest state in the country.
Probably pro gun control,
right? So I want to talk to you because because I'm doing research on how you guys see the world, and I don't understand it, so." So I want to listen to you. I know we're not going to convince each other. We're not going to, you know, you're not going to convince me. I'm not going to convince you. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to try to figure out how you see the world. Will you tell me how you see the world? Would you be willing to talk to me? And the thing is, Dan, that was so interesting is so many of these guys actually feel that they are the forgotten Americans, that nobody's listening to them. Nobody in Washington's listening to them. Nobody in their state government's listening to them. No corporate people are listening to them. And I said, well, I will. I mean, I won't agree, but I want to tell your story as you see it. I want to understand it. So, you know, quite a few of them said no, and, you know, others agreed to meet with me. So Rick was one of my first interviews. And I had rules for how I would meet them. I met him at a diner along a freeway outside of Shippensburg. I sat there, you know, the first time I figured, oh, this is so great. And I took out my little tape recorder and, you know, I was all set for the interview. And as soon as he sat down and he came in wearing like an old flannel shirt and a weathered baseball hat and the flannel shirt was all buttoned up. And so as he sits down, he unbuttons the shirt and he has this sort of black, black T-shirt with a big Confederate flag on it that says the South will rise again. And he looks over at me kind of impishly. He said, I wore this for you. So I knew he had a sense of humor, which was good.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
So I took out the tape recorder and I said, do you mind if I tape this? He said, oh, I can't talk to you because you're probably FBI. I said, okay. So I put the tape recorder away and I sat there and we talked and I bought him breakfast and we talked for a while. And that's basically the way I ended up interviewing these guys was in, lunch.
What did you get from Rick?
Well, I got exactly that sense how did this happen? In Rick's case, his father was actually a union man, had worked in the steel industry. They had moved to the Shippensburg area, but his father actually had worked for Beth Steele in Bethlehem. And he said, you know, I grew up, my family's always was always a steel family. You know, we were members of the union. We made a good living. We worked hard. We had a nice life. And now I can't even get a job. You know, I mean, you know, everybody sort of says the stereotype. He says I can barely get a job at Walmart. You know, there's nobody's hiring.
So who does he blame for that? Does he blame the union?
Ah.
Does he blame unions? Because I often hear these guys, you know, critical of unions.
He thinks the unions basically are in the corporation's pocket.
Yeah, there you go.
They're not interested in big. Let me put it this way. They are fiercely patriotic. They love America, but they hate its government. Similarly, they are ferociously pro-capitalist, but they hate corporations. Their vision is a more Jeffersonian, small yeoman farmers, guys who own their own work, their own labor, their own land, their own shop. They are citizens. They participate. That's kind of their model of who they feel they want to be.
Okay.
And of course,
But Michael, how do you live in the world with those conditions? It's not realistic.
Well, some of them believe that they can actually recreate that in small towns by incorporating the town as white only, by living in, you know, in bands that in on communes. You know, communes used to be a thing of the left, as was homeschooling. Now it's a thing of the right. You know, right wingers have these communes where they don't pay taxes, that they're self-regulating, and they try to reproduce the the New England village, except everybody has several guns. So this is, I mean, of course it's unrealistic, but the idea that something terrible has happened and that they have lost something valuable and that that was their birthright, this is the common complaint. Now, what I was interested in with Rick and with the other guys that I interviewed from the extreme right was how they interpreted that in terms of gender, because a lot of the organizations that try to recruit them basically say that you have lost your manhood. You are now a weak, emasculated wimp. And in order to get your masculinity back, you have to join us. And so masculinity becomes a kind of currency that they feel weak and helpless. And all of their, you know, all of their recruiting things, devices are basically to get these guys to feel first terrible about themselves, that they've lost their masculinity, and then to find the political way to get it back.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Let me ask you this, though. This is an important question. Obama, the election of Obama, it seems to me, from what I hear, that the vitriol escalated after Obama. Although your guys probably say to you, you know, it's not about race. That's not why I'm angry. People think if you're in the Tea Party, you're a racist because of Obama. That's not the case. So you go into this. I go into it as a reporter interviewing people. You go into it as a sociologist doing research, hoping or not maybe hoping. That's not the right word. Keeping an open mind about that, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder, what did you come away with after all these interviews in terms of that allegation that this is really about a black man in the White House?
You know, I had the same experience as you, and I'd be really curious to hear what you came away with also. When I talked to these people, when I talked to sort of some followers of Rush Limbaugh and Mike Savage, when I talked to Tea Party members, when I went out and talked to the angry white men of the extreme right, you know, the first assertion was this wasn't about race. But very quickly, Obama became two things. First, he became a symbol of how far down the wrong hole we had fallen, that we could elect an African American, that is someone who was, you know, both African and American, that we could, I mean, all of those efforts to try to delegitimize Obama, the birther stuff, for example, it was really all about people saying he is not one of us. He's an alien. He's not one of us, and only ones of us should be our leaders. These guys all said that they would never follow him into battle, that they would never, you know, that they would never listen to him, that the world had been turned upside down. And so, in a funny way, you know, in blue state circles, in November of 2008, if you remember, we were patting ourselves on the back. America had become post-racial. Racism had, you know, we you know, I can't be racist because I voted for a black guy. I mean, and we've never been more wrong, because what has happened actually is people have permission to be more overtly racist without much of the coding that used to take place than ever before. And Obama has become a lightning rod for that. During the Bush years, the number of people flocking to websites on the extreme right or the number of people joining went way down until the very end when he, you know, when the war, you know, when it was clear that the war in Iraq was, in their minds, a war for Israel and not a war for Americans. And secondly, that he had basically sold out the white working class on immigration. So they began to abandon Bush. But for those years, membership was very low. When Obama was elected, it has skyrocketed and it has stayed very high. So now there's probably in the United States several hundred thousand actual members of some extreme organization, 200,000-300,000, and probably double that more who are followers of these sorts of organizations. And as you know, the extreme right is also extremely in a great resurgence in Western Europe as well, in part because of Muslim immigration throughout Western Europe.
Michael, we're going to take another break here. Michael Kimmel is a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University. We're speaking to him about his new book, Manhood in America, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, an earlier book, Manhood in America, The Gender to Society, and Guyland, the last time we spoke with Michael Kimmel. The new book, Angry White Men, more on Midday after a short break. Back with Michael Kimmel. His latest book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, published by Nation Books. And Michael, earlier when I was talking to you about or asking you about areas where you think they have these guys have legitimate grievances, I wanted to go to divorce and child custody just for a bit here. Mm-hmm. I thought this was pretty interesting. You write, too often, he says, family court judges act as if they're adjudicating Don and Betty Draper's divorce, referencing their Mad Men. Back in the 1960s, they failed to recognize that fathers these days do a lot more child care than they used to, that mothers should not always be the default caretakers, and that fathers often want to remain an active presence in their child's lives as something beyond a steady paycheck, another sign that many men are in fact getting used to a new world order. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And I hear this from a lot of men complaining, of course, about divorce settlements, but more specifically child custody. Do you just want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's two, there's something really going on around the fatherhood issue, and I talked with them. You know, initially I wasn't going to do something specifically on fathers. I was just interested in some of the men's rights groups who, you know, basically argue that men are the victims of reverse discrimination, which they call misandry, the opposite of misogyny, and that rules in political circles, so they say. Now, I was interested. But the fatherhood issue kept coming up. It kept coming up. And so I decided I was going to sort of break that off and look at the guys who are interested in the father rights movement. And I would say two things. It's exactly what the passage that you quoted was really my experience talking to these guys. Again, they felt like, wait a minute, the courts deal with us as if we're, you know, 1950s dads, and in fact, we're 21st century dads. We have been involved with our kids. We have been, you know, equal parents. We've been equal, you know, our wives have worked outside the home. We've been, you know, we've been dual career, dual care of families. And then suddenly the courts treat us like we're simply wallets and we have no emotional connection, that we simply are, you know, providers and will continue to give people their allowance, so to speak. And these guys are just bewildered and they're completely bereft because, in fact, they had put a lot of emotional energy into their family lives and their children. And it just rips you apart. You know, it's very rare to find a good divorce. But these guys are hurting because they do feel that they've been treated unfairly. And in some cases, they have. Mm-hmm. Now, there are many cases in which they haven't. And the truth is, in the aggregate, most people get the custody arrangements that they ask for. In fact, about 80% of all custody cases, according to researchers at Stanford Law School, about 80% of custody cases end up with the custody arrangements that both parents want. But we're talking about the 20% then that don't. And there's some proportion of guys who really do want to have joint custody and don't get it, and they just feel like their lives have been torn apart. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that there is a difference between men who want joint custody and don't get it and women who want joint custody and don't get it. And the difference is women, after divorce, even if they don't have joint custody or sole custody, almost never lose contact with their children. But men do often drift away. So a significant percentage of those men who don't get joint or sole custody actually have no relationship to their children at all. They move away. Mm-hmm. They start over. And that's a way of healing the pain that, they may feel, but it still leaves a hole in the lives of their children to whom they were so attached earlier.
Now, as for men caught up in divorce or men who father children outside of marriage, you know, I think there's a statistic in your book, women with only a high school degree, nearly 60% of births for them occur outside of marriage.
Yeah.
So more and more, maybe we're seeing an eroding of the idea of masculinity, which you get to in your book, spend a lot of time talking about these ideas of masculinity. The idea, for instance, modeled by the father of a lot of baby boomers, you know, a man who was able to work for one corporation for many years, was able to provide for his family. His wife didn't have to work. All those ideas have been shattered over a fairly short period of time I would say, the last 30 to 40 years.
There's two things that you say, Dan, that I want to comment on. One of them, of course, is that, as you say, a lot of these guys are kind of, as I say, confused. You know, like, well, what's unique about me then? I mean, if it, you know, what do I contribute that's unique to me as the father, as a man? If you know, complete equality doesn't, in my mind, doesn't mean androgyny. It doesn't mean we become the same. You know, there's some differences between women and men, and I'm very happy for them. But a lot of guys are wondering what that might be. But I want to just push back on one thing that you said, and that is the association of negative outcomes for not being married, because in Western Europe. Let's take the prototypical other example. In Scandinavia, the overwhelming majority of parents are not married. But they don't have to be married because they don't have to be covered by each other's health plans. They don't have to be married because everyone in that country who is born in Sweden, for example, who is born in that country gets free education, free health care. So they don't have – so the only reason to get married – is actually for religious reasons, you know, if you're a believer. So I think that in the absence of adequate childcare, adequate healthcare, adequate a parental leave, all the kinds of paid support that you get from the government in order to be a good parent. In the absence of that, people decide, well, we can have children, we can have a life, and I think that those countries are actually redefining family so that people are not, you know, they're not together with one person for life, nor are we, but we are developing new forms of kind of serial parenthood where we have, you know, children and families that combine and recombine in different configurations. This is a grand experiment. And there are many people who are saying this is going to be the worst thing in the world, and others who are saying, well, it's a brave new world, and we're not dependent on these sorts of things any longer, and it may be a greater possibility for greater freedom.
Michael, let's talk.
I'm agnostic on the question.
I'm good with you. I want to just talk about violence for a minute here. You spent a good amount of time on this. We haven't talked about it very much because it seems to be at the extreme. But you do connect this. The anger among white men, especially young men, to acts of violence. It does get that extreme. I mean, it goes from old white guys sitting around the country club griping about Obama to this other extreme where it actually turns into violence against women, violence against the workplace, extreme examples of that. But you see a line there.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the violence in the workplace, these guys who go postal, because that has been historically, you know, overwhelming. It's almost all males. I think it's almost 100% males. And it's certainly, and it's about 90-something percent white males who go postal, as it were. And the thing that's interesting about these guys and these cases, which I found really interesting, and it reveals something about the argument in the book, is when you if you were as a journalist to go out, you know, let's say there's a serial killer who's found, you know, a Jeffrey Dahmer type who's found in the Baltimore suburbs, and you go and you interview his neighbors. And all the neighbors would say, wow, this is really a surprise. He was really a quiet guy, kept to himself, never, you know, seemed sort of friendly. We had no idea. And that would be that's the typical response to finding out that there's a serial killer in your midst. Now, when somebody goes postal, when someone goes postal and you ask their neighbors or you ask their coworkers, you know what they say? They say, oh, we could have predicted that. We saw it coming. Well, we didn't know it was going to be, you know, Bob Smith. We thought it might actually be somebody else. But, you know, this company, 2 years ago, they canceled all of our health benefits. And then they took away our retirement. And then they cut our wages. And now we have no control over our hours. I knew someone was going to snap. So here's an analysis that says the reason this guy went postal and snapped was because his working conditions had been so eroded that he absolutely sort of lost it. And consistently, that's the story of these guys who go postal. Now, that's the analysis that you led with at the top of the hour, mm-hmm. which is that these guys are badly done by. They are, in fact, hurting, and they are right to be angry. Now, am I advocating going postal? Of course not. I am saying that some guys will snap. It's inevitable.
And I just wonder, with the stresses on the Postal Service today, because you mentioned the stresses in the Reagan era, I wonder why we don't see more of it, though. I mean, I'm not asking for more of it. I'm just wondering why it isn't more prevalent today.
You know, it's a good question, and I actually don't have an answer, but it's something I should think about.
Maybe
it's a good question.
Yeah,
what's
on the bright side? I guess I want to ask you here. Are there any bright spots in this picture, Michael? Because our time is short now.
You bet. I do think that there are some bright spots. There's two. First of all, historically, despite the fact that I just wrote this book about angry white men, their numbers are shrinking and will continue to shrink. Because there's very – and this is a real dilemma, of course, for the Republican Party. Because most guys are, in fact, not politically mobilizable simply on the basis of class and race and gender resentment. Most guys are accommodating themselves to a different kind of world, and we're finding that it's actually not a terrible thing at all. So their numbers are, in fact – dwindling, although I think that they're still on the political landscape and need to be talked about. You know, the way that, for example, Joe the Plumber became this sort of great icon overnight. And the second thing, though, is what I just said, but stated a little bit differently. Most of us in the future, young men, the men I talk to on college campuses, my students, there are three things about them that I know that are different from my generation. Number one, they assume, absolutely take for granted, that their wives are going to work outside the home and be just as committed to their careers as they are. This is not a question anymore.
We need to wrap up, Michael. So okay. Go to second, your other points. Yeah.
Okay, second, they know that they expect to be really involved fathers and care for their kids. And third, they all have cross-sex friends. They are much more adept at dealing with women as their equals in the workplace, in public, and also in their relationships. Huh. And that's going to be the big change. No more When Harry Met Sally.
I'm glad we ended with a few bright spots then. Yeah. Michael, I enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your work. Michael Kimmel joining us today from Stony Brook University, where he's Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies. His latest book, the one we've been discussing, is Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, published by Nation Books. Michael, again, thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Great to be with you.
Yep. And everybody who's been listening today, thank you for tuning in to Midday. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, Maya Brown, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.